Welcome to Cybersecurity Insights, the podcast for the cybered.io learning community. Our goal is to bring cybersecurity practitioners the latest and most relevant education and training to upskill and dive deeper into topics that matter in today's modern cybersecurity world.
Good day, everyone. This is Steve King. I'm the managing director at cybered.io. And with me today, I have the fabulous Curry brothers. Sam Curry is the VP and CISO at Zscaler. Sam has been in the space for several decades, as he says, prior executive positions with RSA and Arbor Networks and CA and McAfee and Cyber Recent, et cetera, et cetera. He's a master's degree in counterterrorism, of all things, from Nicholls College, and undergraduate in English philosophy and physics, which will become apparent to you as we continue chatting here.
Sorry, I'm chuckling in the background and shouldn't as you introduce me, but so people know that the creepy chuckle is me. Yeah,
from the University of Massachusetts. And his brother, Red Curry, is the CMO at BeFortified. He's a former also RSA executive and SSH marketeer who has his undergraduate in marketing from University of Massachusetts as well. So I have two Boston boys with me today, and we're going to talk about generative AI and whatever is happening with plagiarism and copyright law vis-a-vis the most recent lawsuit by the New York Times against Microsoft and OpenAI, and so what we think some of those issues should be or are. So with that, Sam, would you like to open? And
So first thing, as you were saying that, I was thinking, man, I also teach. So maybe I should share what my policy is in the course for both coding and for writing around using generative AI and LLMs.
You should.
Yeah. And I'll do that. But then it occurred to me, right as you were finishing, plagiarism implies you're stealing from someone. Right. So is it an admission of sentience on the part of these Gen AI? Or are we implying that somehow the coders who didn't write the stuff, all they did was set up an adaptive computing model that learned from input? Are we implying that they have ownership over the things it makes? Is that a form of digital slavery or something horrible? So I'll go into what my policy is for students, but the word plagiarism implies theft from someone. Right. It implies two things. Well, first of all, that you took it from someone, and secondly, that you're intellectually dishonest enough to claim something as your own that isn't.
Or both of those things. Or you didn't provide attribution. Right.
Right. So that's the first thing for my students that I say is, I actually say, I don't care if anything passes the sentience test or reasoning or what have you. It's a good look to give credit where it's due. Also, I want to understand the tools you use to do something. So whether you are coding or writing an essay, you must cite that you are using this. If you don't, I will consider it plagiarism per the policy of my course, unless I'm overruled by because I teach at two schools and I've taught at others as a guest lecturer and so on. But I say, look, I need this because if you don't do this, then I am not aware of where you're coming from as you write or code. So once you do that, my standards for evaluating you change. And I said, so you must, first of all, you have to cite it. And I don't care if it's sentient or not. What I care about is your development as a student. And so building the fundamentals is one thing, but the minute that you cite it, and now let's take both cases. If you're a coder, I'm going to judge you on the structure of your code. I'm going to judge you on the fact that you got it to be modular, not spaghetti, that you got it to be, that you commented it correctly, how you got to an end goal, and how you effectively governed the LLM and interacted with it. So that's what I'm going to judge you on now. You can't get the basic mistakes. You can't make those basic mistakes anymore. I'm going to judge you now on the quality of the output in a different way than I would if you were, say, in a basic course and not using it. And then when it comes to essays, I have a similar policy. You have to cite it. I still expect academic rigor, by the way. Hallucination, nothing. Like, if it's citing things that don't exist, that's on you. That's an instant fail. If it cites, oh, this was written by, I don't know, John Fernow or something, and that doesn't exist as a source, then fail, right? But I'm also going to judge you now, better have perfect grammar, You better have good style. It had better be exactly APA format. And the content is what I'm going to judge on. Because if any of those structure or style elements are wrong, I'm just going to fail you. That is completely addressable with an LLM. And I said, look, at some point, the college may come up in whatever school it is with a new policy, at which point it overrides mine, but that's mine for the course. And so far, the students have loved it because I've said, look, you're going to go into the world and you're going to have to use these tools. They're going to exist. They're going to be part of your toolkit. It would be silly to hamstring you at this point.
So yeah, all students, that makes sense.
Feel free to jump into it if you want to tear that apart.
There's a lot there, man, but I have to say, it's laughable that you would blame Microsoft or OpenAI rather than the user who intentionally didn't use the tool in a way that wasn't nefarious, right? So somebody had to open ChatGPT and say, write me a paper. I mean, in that case, that's the human being bad. That's not the tool being bad. That's not the tool that did that. So as a graphic designer, when you talk about plagiarism, when I go back to those days and I think about how we build and we create and we develop, we take things from things that have already been created or developed or built. So if I think back to art history, let's take Masaccio, let's take Albrecht Dürer, let's take old paintings, Da Vinci. These things that we learn through art, through writing, Sam's a writer, right? We learn, we read, we develop, we grow, we take things from the past and we develop for the future. That's what we do. So if you're using the tool like ChatGPT, and mind you, HubSpot, Wix, Adobe Creative Suite has integrated AI into their tools, which are graphic design tools. You've got WALL-E, I believe it's called. It's how you use the tool, not the tool's fault. So I would say, as a graphic designer, as a writer, as a product marketer, it's my responsibility to have good ideas, to be thoughtful, to have a voice. Sam, you just said it. Have a voice, have a position, have a style, and use the tool to help guide you through your process as an artist or as a writer, or as a and Steve, even in your role, if you're trying to create something, use it to help elaborate on the things you're trying to create. Don't blame the tool for the human that used it. So you know how we pick on AI, the FUD, here it comes, it's going to ruin us. Wrong. Humans will be the reason why that happened.
People. Yeah, I used to have a mentor, a Lieutenant Commander Robert Garrigue up in Canada. He was a submariner. And he used to say, Sam, much is expected of those to whom much is given. Well, guess what? We're getting an awful lot right now, and we should be doing something with it, to be honest, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, my partner that I make On the Hook with as a podcast, Jacob Berry, it took him hours to edit podcasts. Riverside just included some assistance, and it's now taking him 10 to 20 minutes to do. Our output should go up, right? I mean, this in theory should be making better quality podcasts happening faster because we're able to apply ourselves. The tools become transparent to us. But Red, you were talking about art history. Postmodernism as a general wave in art begged the question, so if cameras can take pictures perfectly, what's the role of the artist? And there was an answer to that, by the way, or one has emerged. Like, forget the God is dead, you know, etc. But like in postmodernism, the answer is that you're capturing something ineffable in art.
I got to jump in.
It's not about a perfect picture. And I've got to let you because I just baited you.
So there's a thing called Getty Images called iStock. News crews and camera crews pay rights and royalty fees to use these images. And we use iStock to create graphics. Every day you scroll into LinkedIn, do not believe that somebody hand drew everything you see in a picture in a post, right? That's just not what happens. They use different pieces of art and vector files and EPS files and Art Illustrated files to create a graphic from different components to build an illustration. 9 times out of 10, what you're seeing now was created by somebody who used bits and pieces from something like an iStock to create a graphic and put a logo on. So what is ChatGPT or what is...
By the way, Red, before you go into what is ChatGPT, that is a college degree. In 4 years, you absorb stuff and it mixes in your mind and then you start to output stuff. At no point does someone say, wait a minute, didn't you read John Donne when you were in your English degree? That didn't happen, right?
Yeah, and
what about Bill say?
Shouldn't you pay the college part of your wage for...
Forever?
You just
cited a metaphysical poet, Sam. You should definitely be paying them for that Milton reference. Like, really?
Now I'm going to jump into something even more sensitive. Now we're going to get into the snobbery of the guild. So you will meet people who believe they're better than they actually are. who believe they've done more than they've actually.
That's the human condition, Ren.
You get people in design, I see it all the time, who say, well, I custom illustrate everything. Well, that's you out of 30,000. There are 50,000 graduates a year in parts of the United States coming out with those degrees in graphic and in graphic arts. They do not all illustrate. Many of them can't illustrate. They use the solution to create the illustration that they had in mind, like Photoshop or Illustrator. They're not naturally gifted painters.
So a couple of very successful fellows have both said essentially the same thing. And that is, you know, if I can steal it, I'm going to steal it, right? And that was Picasso and Jobs, right? So,
It's not theft if it creates something that new.
Right. It's not, not that I can't.
I want to caveat that. There are rules about the ingredients and who gets certain rights and royalties and licenses. But if you are adding and you are doing so in a legitimate way, that has value. It's not mere theft.
Of course there would be. But you know, that's why the AI Act in Europe has stalled out, right? I mean, they've taken pushed it out a year plus two, whatever it is, 2 years, I guess now. And they're going to struggle with that, and I don't think we're going to come.
The Europeans are pretty good, by the way, waiting to see the mistakes others make and then learn from them, right? So
it's the same reason why Congress will never come up with a way to regulate AI in this context, where you know you're going to modify copyright laws to do what? To make somehow me liable for using a tool that changed an original story. That came from what? Where? My imagination combined with Wikipedia data, combined with all of the crap that came out of the LLM from the web. I mean, who owns that stuff anyway, right? Mm. And so you can't get what you want me to, you know, if I watch, you know, 20 videos on how to be a plumber or 20 videos on how to be a landscape gardener or something, then I go out and become a landscape gardener. Do I have to pay the?
Although the plumbing, there could be insurance issues. Yeah, so yeah, but the landscape gardener, absolutely.
But do I have to go back and pay those people because they had all of the, they gave me all of this data? That's a silly analogy, but
it's not silly though. It's a really good one, and it's the same thing is true with 3D printing, right? So how do you license what the 3D printer can do downstream? It is how we use and employ technology. By the way, I think that there's also a what skills are going to be valuable in an AI-enabled world. And I think that I've certainly seen two types of skills, two classes. The first is because of leaky abstraction. That is, when we work at just the interface, we need to understand how it works under the hood. We still need some STEM, and we still need to understand how these things work as part of a fundamental trend. You need to know how the answers are given to you in order to be able to deal with the output. So that's still there. But I actually think this is going to be a heyday for the liberal arts. And for what we've called the soft sciences in the past, that I'll give you examples. Philosophy, understanding logic so that you can understand when something is a valuable output or not. Ethics, what should you and shouldn't you do? Just plain explaining why, because we've avoided a lot of ethics discussion because it verges on things like religion in our country. And so people are terrified of it, but we need to have those conversations. What is an ethical framework and when are you making those decisions and how do you publish that? So when the AI makes decisions, because it gets built in not just to something like a language model, but into physical kinetic things, we have to have ethics discussions. Sociology and psychology, what is the impact on us as humans and as human societies, right? So there's a ton of these things that we've thought of as liberal arts or soft sciences in the past that are actually really important because we can focus on them. And because the decisions we make with AI now have such a huge impact. So I just throw that out there too, because now we get to, so when you create something or when you use something, how do you advance the sciences? How do you validate the output if some of the research is being done by an AI? And whose is it? And how do you do academic attribution?
And just to be clear, you know, the earlier reference to Picasso wasn't that he literally stole somebody else's image, but that he stole the inspiration for his image from that prior image.
And the arts themselves.
Michelangelo did that all the time and it freely admitted it. That's how art gets created.
The human role in this system is going to be about the ineffable. It's going to be about you know, not just the perfect image, but the meaning and the impact of that perfect image. And it's not fuzzy. It's something that needs to be explored through art.
I want you to think about this. There's a wonderful artist named Dick Detzner, and he created some really, let's just say they're edgy, edgy pieces of art. We're using characters that we have in modern commercial businesses. Call it Twist, call it Rice Krispies guys. And he took them and he put them into some very
registered trademark.
Like The Last Supper, which was really The Last Breakfast.
Oh, I remember that picture, yeah.
Who guards in it? Was he stealing the art of Quisp and Rice Krispie guys and Tony the Tiger? No, he was using other art to create more art to give a message. So we use...
Oh, that's a great point. Like, what could he do it? Could he do it within an AI world?
Did Kellogg sue him? No, they didn't sue him. They realized there was a beautiful piece of art and a message to be created. But you see this happening all the time. And I think, Sam, you and I talked about earlier this bubble bursting with AI. What they once said, radio will rot your brain. Then TV will rot your brain. Then the PC will rot your brain. Then video games will rot your brain. And then you hear parents saying, my kid's on YouTube all day long. It's killing them. They don't know how to talk.
And now we talk about the advantages of it, right? All that stuff. But AI will be your rotted brain now.
I'll go back to the first point, like AI and plagiarism and how we thought video games would rot our kids' brains and YouTube. They won't. They just won't. We'll advance in a new way. We'll learn new. We'll make new strides. But it's the human that's responsible, not the solution. And if you're hiring somebody that you're afraid is having ChatGPT write its papers, do its blogs, do its homework, that's a
problem. Yeah, then you have a problem with the person. Yeah,
not the tool.
Yeah, I mean, honesty and citation is generally a good look. By the way, Steve, what Red's referring to is this morning we read an article by Cory Doctorow, who's a science fiction writer and a futurist, and he wrote, he wrote about the AI bubble bursting, but what sort of AI bubble is it? What sort of bubble is it? Is it the sort that leaves value behind when it pops, or is it the sort that leaves just devastation behind? And he gave the example of WorldCom, that when that bubble burst, there was fiber optic cable left behind. And Enron, when it burst, it was just devastation left behind. Another example, the dot-com bubble actually left behind value. Now, that doesn't mean that it didn't also cause damage, but basically he's saying it's undeniable that AI is a bubble, and it is on the rise right now, or it's increasing as a bubble if we keep the metaphor going. When it pops, will it leave value behind? And Red and I were thinking it will, because we're seeing it turn up in things, as he said earlier. And it is leaving value.
If it pops, this is unlike anything we've ever seen before. So to compare it to, I think Doctorow's a smart guy, but to compare it to WorldCom or,
those are just examples of bubbles. But I think anytime you get something that is like this, there's a tendency to overinvest in it. So anything really valuable that comes along quickly will get inflated. And it will probably get a little overinflated, and therefore it's a bubble. Well, and it's all around Silicon Valley, it's all AI.
I know lots of people who refuse to accept ChatGPT as a tool for their profession, whether they're in marketing or sales or journalism or editorial or what have you, because they're bound to these principles and these best practices and attribution and the... And if you're a journalist,
a lot of generals in World War I refused to use tanks, right?
Or are they afraid that it might open the door to other creative minds to step into a world they never had the opportunity to step into?
Well, that's what I think.
And so I think they're just afraid. And Bert, Steve, take the fear away, Sam. .com led to what we now refer to as the digital transformation. Exactly. The dot-com bubble created, so it left behind something massive that you read on LinkedIn.
Down the road, it led to SaaS, for instance, and it led to cloud, right? I mean, but you're right. This is the start, and a lot of those people, they're either afraid or they're in denial. Yeah. Maybe they just haven't seen it, but nevertheless, the world is changing.
Oh, but they used the same argument that the New York Times used in that complaint against Microsoft and OpenAI, that they were stealing this incredible intellectual property in which they've invested so much human capital, right? Mm-hmm. And that human capital had this huge value. And so they're going after this enormous unknown statutory amount of damage here. That's what happens when you're, over the last 5 years, your subscription rate continues to decline. The quality of your work, nobody cares about. You have paywalls around everything. And
they must hate all those students who are reading their stuff and using it too. I mean,
it's 99 cents for the Boston Globe now, and they're begging you to read it when I can get it for free on Google News. Like, I don't have to go to you anymore, and I don't need a paper thrown at my front door. This is the problem. And I think one of the things is, to Steve, your point around the bubble bursting, I think it's already kind of burst in a weird way because of the way in which previous bubbles have. Now we move at a different speed. The speed of information, the speed of adoption, the speed of innovation, the speed of versioning, the drive to make things happen now, that culture that we live in, now. This is my favorite, and you've opened up my crazy. Our leadership team, our sales teams, even our kids, our shopping habits, Amazon, Google, right? Get it now, have it now. Is it at my house? Have it delivered. Ask a question, get an answer. That's what humans like, whether right, wrong, good, bad, funny, or sad. We need to Google it. If you think about it, my management teams over the years have said, when will it be ready? When will we get it out? When will this launch? You want it fast. Do you really want it fast, or are you going to fight it? These companies like New York Times are afraid that it could be done faster than they could do it, better than they can do it, and maybe somebody else has a different idea.
Well, they thought, Red, the Fourth Estate was inviolable. It doesn't have to be done their way.
Right.
And the industry's changed.
I have yet to find, I think I found maybe one New York Times story that I couldn't find elsewhere through Googling it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it isn't the magical quality of the journalism that turns me on here. I'm looking for the story, right?
Yeah.
I don't care about, you know.
Yep.
You're given words.
If I want a great story, I'm going to read Wired, right?
Yeah.
And you're given word soup. Right. You want the long pieces. Okay. That's different. That's your Wired, right?
Yeah.
But you're given word soup for something timely. You're like, okay, what the headline, the main facts, like tell me what actually happened. And then you hit a paywall and you're like, all right, I'm getting it somewhere else or it's not timely.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And I'll go into one more because it pulls me in. You guys have pulled me into this, but Google added AI to their search engine already, right? Adobe has it built into the Creative Suite. HubSpot has it integrated in an AI solution. Wix has it. And this isn't to benefit the big corporations. This is for self-starter small businesses like folks who open gyms, young entrepreneurs who want to create something, build a website. So the leave behind has already begun, right? I think that leak has already happened. And I'm pretty excited about it because opportunity and growth for everybody. It's a playing field where I think humans can do better, try harder. And this is a way to help them do that, I think.
I think, Red, you're right. I think you're onto something. There's a number of, shall we say, unorthodox economic trends or stimulants that kind of defy the expectation. We see at the macro level, people are going, wait, unemployment's where it's at and inflation's where it's at. And why are the normal levers for the economy not producing the results we expect?
Well, and so, yeah, you know, you alluded to it when we talked about, you know, the being in denial. Denial translates also to, you know, hiding behind some protection so that you don't have to participate on that playing field because, God forbid, you might not be good enough. You're only good enough in the context of, hey, I'm an elite whatever, and I've surrounded myself with elite whatevers, and I hang with those people so I know who I am. And all of a sudden, all those barriers are gone, and somebody like Red or Steve or Sam can come and play. Oh, shit. Right.
And what's interesting is beware of digital protectionism for this reason. And doom scrolling is one thing, but I'm interested in seeing what the trends are in the sort of memes or ideas that are going by. And I don't mean memes like jokes. What I'm noticing is there was fear mongering earlier this year about AI, quote, taking over. I mean, come on. But where we're at today, that's not a reality. Where it may go in the future, yeah, okay, but it's not tomorrow. Now what we're seeing is fears of digital feudalism is being thrown around. If you really look at the occasional odd article creeping in, what that's saying is don't trust these bigwigs who have access to these engines. And it's by the very elements in the economy that are afraid that their cheese is being moved. I'm going to mix too many metaphors. And they're asking for digital protectionism effectively. Hey, wait.
I am a very special thing because of how I report on the news. And therefore, damn you all, the greatest theft in human history has happened, and I'm the victim, and I should get reparations for it. No, you know what? You've had a long run as a newspaper. And once the generation that still buys print is gone, you are not the best way to get it necessarily. And the market may determine it other ways, and technology might equip it.
Sam, I want to throw something out there.
Mm.
You brought this lawsuit. Who wrote the article that was plagiarism? who wrote the piece? So if you're going after the person who created it, that makes sense. So I would argue your lawsuit's against the wrong person. Somebody wrote an article, somebody created something, and that they're making the claim that somebody had taken it from them. Don't be afraid of the tool.
Oh, yeah, but it's also juvenile, right? It's quis custodia ipsos custodies. Who watches the watchman, right? Or guards the guardians.
Trust the people that you have on your team. That they're doing the job the way they do it. You know who they are. You know how they write. You know their style. You know their stuff. Same with art. Same with anything we do. We can't be afraid of these things because I think it'll lead to the next evolution, the next jump. Mm-hmm. This is one of those things like .com that led to the next wave of cloud and SaaS, as Sam put it. This is that next thing that will eventually be embedded into our day-to-day lives. It'll be something that we use to support us. And it comes back to the human. We have to trust the people that are using it, trust the people that are growing it. As you said, in the future, will it come after us? No, not if we manage it properly, not if we regulate it properly, not if we watch it and train it properly. Obviously, we're going to do that because we've already had these conversations. We're having it now.
And but these are precisely the things that are based in, quote, soft sciences. This is precisely the sorts of things that we should be having conversations about and looking to history for. It's scary because The other thing is that the rate of change is increasing, and the combinatory effect of changes is perhaps it's the law of accelerating returns. When too many changes happen at once, the term singularity was coined. Like, take the hype of a singularity aside. When you get a lot of advances in a lot of domains at the same time, the combinatory effect of it can be destabilizing. And so there is no, hey, slow down the merry-go-round here so that we can reassess. Which means we have to start figuring out what this stuff is doing to us individually, humans, and generationally, and societally as we go.
I want to go funny, Steve, for a second. You ready?
Here we go.
I want to bring up something that Sam and I did. It was a funny experiment.
I don't remember what he's talking about. Here we go.
We tested these challengers to ChatGPT by giving them some of Sam's older blogs. Now, I'm not the one.
Oh, yeah.
He's smart. So I took a bunch of his and I put it into one of these ChatGPT checkers. Sam's blogs back in 2008 and 7 were 99% written by a ChatGPT, a language learning.
I didn't tell you, Ren, I have a time machine. And it's my secret.
Really?
Yeah.
How
I do.
Inaccurate. So if we haven't got the AI writing it right part, how do we have the checkers for it right? For a guy who is pretty bright, not me, that was you, Sam, who wrote these blogs that I jumped into one of them and it said, no, he didn't write those.
Wow. Yeah.
Or shit. Yes. Sorry.
But then again, hey, if this is all a simulation, then humans are the AI, right? So whatever. I'm joking. Was that a bridge too far? Was that?
Maybe a little. The copyright issue is different, right, than the plagiarism issue. And
yeah, that's a good point.
We're going to have to figure that out. And yet, while the issues are different, the analogy is kind of still applies, right? I mean. What the original intent of copyright in the era of print was to protect people from other people directly lifting their particular, in the case of writing, copy, and then reusing it without permission, right? I mean, that's the whole
thing. Yeah, because the very act of publishing put it out there, and then it would be effectively used before you could realize the gain. Yeah.
But remember, ChatGPT is doing it alone. There's a human.
So my question, though, is how much of that, what would we allow if we were judge and jury here? What would we allow to change? You know, what percentage, how would you measure that if we said, okay, well, what we can do is we can assume that as long as there is some human net add, some innovative net add to the story. So you pick three paragraphs that I wrote once, and then
Sam adds something to paragraph one and Reddit something to paragraph two. Is that an infringement upon my copyright? And you go ahead and publish that, right? I mean, is that an infringement upon my copyright, or was one word sufficient to infringe upon copy? Or if you published it as in situ?
I think the beauty of what we do every day as humans, when we work, we play, we live, the beauty is how we contribute to each other's conversations. Steve, if you wrote something, Sam is never going to write back words within your paragraph. Sam's going to write back, oh, but have you thought of this? And have you got this idea? And could we add that? And Red's going to say, I got a really cool visual for this that might get the point across. The thing that we do with ChatGPT is we don't say ChatGPT or any of the other tools out there, write me this or make me that. That is irresponsible, stupid. What we do is we build things together and we collaborate. That's the part of the human that's wonderful, right? So if you think about it, if we were to write something together and we took some words, we wouldn't take the words. We'd read the context. Sam mentioned this author today in a blog that we read. We understood what he was saying and we're talking about it right now, right, Sam?
Yeah.
We're not stealing from him. We just gave him credit. We're talking about it. We're breaking it down. We're dissecting it. And if you took the transcript from this chat we had right now, and you printed it and you put it on a blog or you put it somewhere, did we just rip him off? No. We had a good conversation and we elevated the story to another place and we've taken the conversation deeper. So if we write something, say it's a topic, I don't know, pick any topic. Well, there's obviously going to be somebody else who's already spoken about it. It's how we take the angle. It's the story we make from it, right? Marketers do marketing every day and they each tell a story about their cybersecurity companies. Is somebody doing identity access management at, say, RSA, or identity access management, say, somewhere else, are they stealing from each other? They have a different story, but the same subject. So it's how we talk about it. It's our idea.
There's some. You're right, Red, but have either of you heard of The Frost King by Helen Keller? In 1891, she wrote a short story and was accused of plagiarism. We're talking about Helen Keller here, right? So she had a teacher named Sullivan who described some autumn leaves to her. And so she imagined a fairy king and his court, I think, and I apologize if I get this wrong and somebody can correct it in comments or whatever, and how those leaves got their colors, the sort of autumn colors. And I think the title of the thing was called Autumn Leaves. Well, then somebody accused her of plagiarism. And it was this, the wording and the ideas of one snippet had gotten through her teacher to her, and at 11 years old, she'd written this story and was accused of plagiarism because the person was named Margaret Canby. She had a book called Birdie and His Fairy Friends, and the book came out exceptionally similar. There was no humanly possible way she had read it. And so the question was, had somebody read it to her? And then was she intellectually dishonest at 11 years old to write it? No, it was one snippet from which she derived a story that was largely similar, even in wording. We're talking 1890s, not 1990s. And so this is long before AI, unless they have the same time machine that I have, right? Like, this is this is highly, highly unlikely. So then the question became, if you asked an AI to come up with a cookie recipe, right? And it happens to match, I don't know.
Cook it home?
Pick up your favorite. Your favorite famous author, chef, right? Their cookie recipe, is it plagiarism? Maybe did they get it from their cook? No, well, if the cookie recipe is significantly different and it says to include turmeric, chili powder, and some special kind of honey from Madagascar, maybe, right? But if it's a basic cookie recipe, probably not. And so a lot of this has to be interpreted through law and common law and so on. Sorry, Steve, I talked over you.
No, that's exactly what you just said. Now it's time to interpret that through common law. How do we do that?
And that's our system, yeah.
What does Congress do? You know, they're completely incapable of much to begin with. But, you know, this is a domain that none of these people understand and haven't, I don't think, have the critical thinking skills, frankly, and is my observation, to actually think through this process. So the cookie recipe is a great example, right? I mean, how many cookie recipes for chocolate chip cookies must there be out on an LLM somewhere, right?
There's a ton, and they're like all 98% the same.
Exactly, right? Because there's only...
And I love them all, by the way. That's my problem. I love all those cookies, yeah.
So before we regulate it, we talk about educating.
Well, yeah, and but here's the thing. People need to, so your distinction between plagiarism and copyright is really important, right? Plagiarism is a notion, copyright is a law. And while they're highly related, the same thing is true with patents, right? There's a similar basis. There is law, and then there's jurisprudence and how it's interpreted. And in common law, previous interpretations carry forward and have weight with them until, and it's an ongoing dialogue with the law. In effect, I'm not a lawyer, right? But this is my understanding of it. And I think, Steve, you probably have more experience on the law side than I do, if I recall. And so how it plays out is not a foregone conclusion. And there's a lot of things that will influence how the laws are written, if they're written at state and federal in the United States or in other common law countries, like former Commonwealth countries and so on. And that's not the same as, say, Napoleonic Code, right? Or some of the Muslim codes that are out there in other countries. But in our system, that's how it works. And there's a lot of influences on that system and on the courts that interpret it and on the juries. So I don't want people to think, hey, there's one way to do it. There's the notion of right and wrong and how we intellectually get to it and how we influence the discussion. There's how the laws get created. And then there's how the interpretation in the courts happen and how they get influenced. And those three things are not a foregone conclusion.
Right. No,
from a global point of view, we have no agreement. And no general agreement among countries that they're going to look at it the same way, right? I
mean, and this is one of the main points of contention that existed in Brexit between the UK's legal system and legislative system and the generally presiding one over the European Union. They worked differently culturally that way.
Yeah, sure. And the UK and we can decide, you know, on how we want to go about it, but there are four countries come to mind that are going to say, screw you, we're going to do whatever we want.
At least four. Yeah, you're right.
Let's dig into copyright for a second. I know we talked your ear off, Steve, but let's get into copyright because this is my favorite. So Nike probably gets up against copyright infringement several times a year. Converse will call it Facebook. Lots of companies, McDonald's, lots of companies will come up with this, Coca-Cola. The question is, the process doesn't change because of AI and the tools. Does the process change now when a company creates a copyright infringement on another? No, it's they go after the human and the company. So if somebody wants to blame somebody for copyright infringement on a design, on a piece of writing, that's on the company and the individual
so far,
not the tool, right? Like I have Adobe, I use Photoshop. If I go make a logo that looks like Nike and I take the swoosh, are they going to go sue Adobe? Nope. That's the tool I use to make it.
Well, they may go after Adobe because you don't have deep pockets like they do. And that's why they went after OpenAI and Microsoft, right? As opposed to whoever wrote that story. So that's always going to be the case, I think. But it's the tool that created that, actually. I mean, yes, you created it using the tool, but you could argue, and in the case of ChatGPT, it's more straightforward because you can literally, you know, dump the PDF in, tell it to rewrite it in the style of, you know, I don't know, Tom Brokaw, and then boom, there you have the story. And then you publish that story. Who's doing the copyright infringement? Is it ChatGPT or you?
I would say.
By the way, you would say, but the law is what will ultimately determine it. Because there was a point at which in U.S. history, corporations started to be treated like people and then eventually gained rights like people and then rights beyond what people have. And corporations are involved in this too. And at some point, some kinds of AI may develop rights under the law that are like people or like corporations or tied to either or their own. We don't know what's coming there.
I like what Steve said, though, because at that point, ChatGPT never would have written the Tom Brokaw article if I hadn't hit enter. Much like the gun doesn't shoot if I don't pull the trigger, much like the car doesn't hit a person if I don't drink. It's the person that guides it. And that's the thing about the with AI that bothers me so much, is we're blaming the AI and we're forgetting about the human. And I want to, it's a boring, tired statement.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
no, and it's a good
one. I'm going to keep pushing the human because we're so afraid of this thing. Look, Elon Musk said, don't let AI meet the people. Well, guess what he did? He started a very big AI company just shortly after that statement because he didn't want people having...
Oh, yeah. Well, no, but he not only that, he actually made it one that had no boundaries on it with Grok, which is even more. Anyway, right. I'm going to leave that alone.
No, but what I'm saying is it's...
That's why he acquired Twitter.
But that's what, for me, Steve, it comes down to the human. The responsibility and the onus to me is on the human part of it because we have to push enter. if someone's grabbing an article and making it in the voice of Tom Brokaw, then shame on them for doing that. ChatGPT wouldn't just initiate an article and send it in. So somebody had to do it. And I think we need the laws, which you're asking about, I think is great. But let's start with the laws on the, put a little bit of that responsibility on them. If you're going to do it and you want to hit enter, prepare to be shunned and taken out for posting such a thing.
So two points I want to make, guys. The first is that everyone I always hear is worried about what AIs will do. And most of the examples, like, hey, you know, an AI-operated drone could kill someone. I'm sorry, but in the last year, tens of thousands of people have been killed by drones operated by humans. So it's kind of hard to get worked up about that when it's happening right now around the world, right? In places like the Ukraine, drones are killing people. And they're not AI-operated. They're human-operated. Now, yes, okay, well, they're worried about it in industrial scale. That's fine. The second point that I want, but I do want to put that in the conversation, because humans are doing pretty awful things without needing AI to help. The second thing is that I am worried about when we govern AI-derived speech, we will wind up limiting freedom of speech. And this is super important. You mentioned my counterterrorism background. Hate speech is not illegal. The minute you start to police hate speech, the question of who defines it and where it goes comes up. Either compelled speech or blocking speech. And I draw the line, and I've said this in the past, and others have too. It's not that hard to do, but when it incites violence or crime, okay, that shouldn't be allowed. And nobody likes to hear hate speech. Nobody wants it. But the minute you say you can't say X, then the X variable can be defined by the next political group to be something else. And one of those things could be, you can't say that because it was AI generated. So Red's example, where my blog from 2008 was judged to be AI generated, if a rule came out that said in a political campaign, you can't use AI generated stuff, then a blog that I write could be censored because a bad interpreter says it's AI made. And that could not, that maybe they have made it specifically to censor some political perspectives. And it might take 2 years for it to be found out in court, by which point somebody's been elected or not. I am very concerned by the tools that we put on governing AI in freedom in speech becoming limitations on freedom of speech, if that makes sense.
But it's already a problem, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but here's where we get where we've tried to put controls on hate speech for all the right reasons, and it can wind up dramatically impacting freedom of speech. And we as a society have made rulings on that. And now we're going to come up with AI influenced or created speech, and it could have the same kind of effect on freedom of speech.
How is, you know, from a forensics point of view, you know, how do you even know? I mean, you go back.
Well, you can't. I mean, you might at a point in time, but as with any, it's really an arms race.
But look at the Tom Brokaw example, alluding to. Who's to say, right, that GPT took that original work and then created something else out of it? Who's to say that I did that if I'm the actual perp? I'm the guy that fed that.
Or if Tom Brokaw did it. Right. Yeah. It's
but right. I mean, how do you prove that? How do you prove that the perp?
The answer is you don't. The answer is you don't. The answer is you don't. Even in some cases, you can't trust the person who's the deep fake.
How can you bring that case to court of law?
It is bounded in time, because over time, there will always be ways to both break it and to create it that evolve. But if we say with the technology levels at roughly 2019, 2020 levels, can we beyond a reasonable doubt say that that was an emulation of someone? But going forward, you can never guarantee it or prove beyond a shadow of a doubt. And so we have to find better ways. By the way, Red and I have also talked about creating I had an idea for an invention, so I'll out my own entrepreneurial idea, which is the embedding of certain signals in legitimate videos that can then be interpreted, as opposed to AI. Because especially if you use cryptographic techniques for non-audible and not visual to the human eye in certain recordings, I don't mind people do this because I won't have the time. But basically, if you use cryptographic techniques to create signals, you can then effectively decrypt when you watch the video. AI can't. It still can't break, and at least until quantum computing comes along more effectively, they still can't create, along with the deepfake,
the signal that's embedded, the steganographically included cryptographic signal. So there are ways for you to say, this is my message and I approve of it. And by the way, check the code and you can decrypt it and tell. But most Mark 1 watchers will be watching the news and not decrypting it. You'd have to give people, you know, decryption devices or some form of application that would change, say, the border color and say this one is from the issuer. But again, we get into, you still can't prove it, it's fakeable. Like, there are ways to break this. Yeah, it's just, yeah, our goal is to raise the cost to break, not to hit, you know, 100% trust. You never get.
Yeah, given what we said about the speed of change and the arc of the trajectory we're now in, that, you know, who cares anyway? I mean, you know, people are, yeah, it's like, Jesus, do you have
time? Some people do. I would say most individuals don't, but some collectives do. And what worries me is things like geopolitical influence, special interest groups, organized crime. They sure do, because at scale, they can take advantage of it.
Yeah, but they're the ones that are already doing it.
Yeah. So now we have to figure out collective defenses against it or responses.
I don't know of any of those.
Me either at this point. So elect people wisely in the next election.
Okay.
Steve, to your point, I'll just use the New York Times as a great example, right? It's the fear of being left behind overtaking their method of reinventing themselves so they can survive, right? You can sue all day, but if you're not ready to grow, look, libraries hate Barnes & Noble, and Barnes & Noble hates Kindle. Grow up. Figure it out. Reinvent. Be cooler. Be better. Be smarter. Be faster. Don't sue people just because you got...
Kindle hates libraries. Just,
you're getting left behind. It's 99 cents. Like I said, they throw it at my door. It's 99 cents. Or it's nothing. It's please read, and would you recommend it and throw it at any...
But if it's free, you're probably the product, and I think... There's an argument there.
Organizations that are suing are the ones who aren't reinventing. They're the ones who are feeling left behind and being taken. Stop worrying about it. If you wrote the article already, you already did it. Why would you go back over it? Just keep moving forward. Those who are rewriting your article are old. That's old news. That's like me selling last week's newspaper to you. It doesn't make any sense. So that's the thing I think is they're, to your point earlier, they're losing money. They're not reinventing. They don't know where to go next or how their next business begins. But the idea of suing something over someone, I think that comes back to that fear. So we do have to find a way, and I don't know it either.
And by the way, Steve, I hope that whoever's editing this has an AI to help. And for the record, we certainly, Red and I, give all rights to ISMG to use this podcast and anything the AI derives from it. So there you go.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you all. And look, this is great, I think. I think it's an important topic, and I think we did a pretty good job of scratching.
There's so much more, but hopefully this stimulates people listening to go in those directions, because we're not...
You know, that's the whole point, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And your last pearl of wisdom, Red, I think is spot on. That's the bottom line here. You know, if AI threatens you, it's probably because you're unwilling to jump in and be that next person that you need to become. And it's all there for us.
Or something called Roku's Basilisk, and I've just committed a terrible thing to even mention it, and I'll let people go Google that on their own.
Okay. So thanks to Red and Sam, and a great session with the Curry Brothers again today. And until next time, I'm Steve King, your host, signing off.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Cybersecurity Insights. You can connect with us on LinkedIn or Facebook, or send us an email at social@cybered.io. For more information about the podcast, visit cybered.io/podcast. Until next week, stay safe and secure, and we'll see you on the next episode of Cybersecurity Insights.